Welcome to the KPMG Emergency Management Dialogues podcast. In each episode, we sit down with emergency management and government leaders to dive into their compelling experiences, stories, and insights. Let's listen in.
All right, how's everybody doing today? My name's Ross Ashley. I'm a senior director at KPMG. And with me today, we have Colonel Sean Talmadge, who is the Virginia State Coordinator and Deputy Homeland Security Advisor for the Commonwealth of Virginia. Sean has had a distinguished career, both in public service for over 25 years at the state and local level, as an incident commander, critical care paramedic, firefighter, along with many other positions. Colonel Talmadge is also a citizen soldier in the Commonwealth's Virginia Army National Guard, where he has had many different positions and is still serving today. Sean has received many awards, including the Bronze Star, Purple Heart, and the Combat Action Badge, as well as many others. Colonel, thanks for being with us today, and how are we doing?
Well, just a wonderful morning out here in Virginia, and Ross, just I really appreciate the opportunity to kind of have a chat. I always enjoy our conversations. We always learn more about each other, but more importantly, just some of those golden nuggets that help us be better leaders.
You bet, sir. And that's kind of the focus of this conversation today is leadership, and leadership specifically in emergency management. You know, you and I both have had extensive training in the military and things of that nature, but emergency management's different, right? And it's obviously a civilian profession, but many of the traits are similar from a leadership standpoint. And just kind of wanted to start off there that, you know, we talked a little bit about this notion of implementing a shared consciousness across the enterprise at the Commonwealth's Emergency Management Agency. Tell me a little bit about that and what's going on there.
Well, first, that term emergency manager, we could have a whole another podcast. Is that truly a contemporary, description of what we're doing? It's really crisis leadership, and crisis management is probably a better term. And just because of the types of incidents that we're managing or expected to manage nowadays. But, you know, in the military, they have this idea about mission command, where they kind of decentralize as much as possible decision-making, and they power down so that the person that has the most information can make a decision and basically react to the environment more quickly. And, you know, I've read a couple books, and some people call it shared consciousness. And so the way I would describe it is, you know, shared consciousness is your organization maintaining full understanding of their mission and how they fit into that overarching mission, you know? And remember, it's like, it takes an entire organization to be successful, right? Procurement, they can't buy anything until they have someone that says, hey, I need to buy something. Or, hey, information technology folks, they can't do their job unless they know the requirements of the organization. So the database to do GIS will not exist unless there's a user, and then also, you know, the back end support. And you see that throughout emergency management and crisis management, you know, whether it's the planner supporting a locality, and then the exercise folks comes in to validate the plan, and it just goes on and on. And so it's really making those connections across your entire organization. That's part of that shared consciousness, because I really need to know what you do, because we all support each other in the end. And don't forget too, is that shared consciousness is within your organization, but also with your stakeholders, right? In emergency management, crisis leadership, we don't own anything. We don't have all the fire trucks. We don't have all the helicopters. We really rely on those partnerships and establishing, you know, connections with logistics capabilities across the board, all the above, right? And so that consciousness in terms of relationship needs to exist outside the organization too, which is kind of an important perspective to have as well.
It's interesting in that a lot of these things are new to emergency management, right? And every time I start talking about this, I go back to Joint Pub One, the old purple book, right? You know, we talk about centralized planning and decentralized execution, right? We talk about, you know, one of the things I still think we struggle with in this emergency management realm is the notion of going from deliberate planning to crisis action planning. And that transition point at the moment of a disaster or an event or whatever taking place, that doctrinal shift from deliberate planning to crisis action planning, I still think we're struggling with a little bit in this community. From a doctrinal perspective, it seems like if you go to one EOC, it's different on how they handle that transition. How's that happening in Virginia?
No, you're bringing up a great point. Like, I think, you know, we're always under this evolution process where we're trying to get smarter, more efficient, more effective. And I think there's just this natural process where we learn, hey, what are other people doing? What are, where can we gain, efficiencies and the like? And remember, at the same time, what you and I are doing in terms of crisis management is evolving as well. These weather forecasts and patterns are much more complicated and just so much harder to plan for and react to. And we see dramatic changes in a hurricane track. Like, these things, it's been unreal and trying to anticipate this impact. So, what we're seeing is a demand for an organization that is more flexible and more nimble. And that's able to flip between, deliberate planning and then crisis action planning, because deliberate planning is really good. It happens during, blue sky days. Everything's calm. Everything's cool. But remember, that very first part of that plan is, hey, here's our assumptions. So we have this wonderful plan. We exercise it. But because of our changing environment, like, we have to have the ability for our network to react faster than the leader can make a decision. And I think that's what we're really getting at is, so how do you and I train the organization and delegate authorities and decision making so that the network can basically respond faster and take into account some of the variables in the challenges that we're seeing, whether it's a pandemic response, a weather event, a truck rally running around 495 around DC. These are really volatile, environments now. And so what you and I got to do is develop leaders of the future, right? Down to the lowest level possible. So that once they sense a change, they say, hey, this assumption is no longer valid. We need to make an adjustment and go forward. Yeah.
Some recent changes, like in leadership and things of that nature. And I've always said that there's a reason you end up with military people, firefighters, and police officers, former of those three categories, as emergency managers, because we really haven't done a good job of training our core professional emergency managers that have come up through the ranks there. There hasn't been a mechanism in place to teach leadership, like we have professional military education that doesn't focus on your job, it focuses on leadership. And we're beginning to see beginnings of that. FEMA starting to do things like Vanguard, chief of staff programs, and things of that nature. I think that is something that is critical because, if you think about it, what you're talking about here is built on a lot of trust. It's built on trust from the leader to the delegation, all of that. And building that trust starts with an understanding that those folks understand their leadership roles. Whether, in the military, if you're an enlisted guy or a senior non-commissioned officer, a field grade officer, there's an expectation of the level of leadership, right? And I think we need to press that down into emergency management from everywhere from your entering personnel to division leaders to section chiefs to ESF people that are running different ESFs or lifelines or however you're organized, to have that confidence that not only, because these people are, they are experts in emergency management. And how do we get those experts in emergency management the leadership training they need to move forward and take on those bigger responsibilities?
Yeah, I was going to bring up the whole trust thing, and I have a vignette like from a personal experience thing, because it is, leader development is really, it's a personal experience. It's based on a whole number of variables, and you can teach leadership all day long, but until you experience it and practice it, I would argue you're not going to really develop, right? And so we have to put our folks in environments where you and I can stress them and force a decision and learn from it, right? But there's a going back to the whole trust thing, it's really about culture. You know, as an executive leader, I think one of my number one priorities, or actually a number one responsibilities, is establishing an organizational culture. And a part of that, you know, is mission command or shared understanding. It's trust, and the trust goes two ways, right? You know, in a positive working environment where teammates, and notice I'm not saying employees, I'm saying teammates, feel comfortable making decisions, and that leaders like you and me are underwriting risk. Because if we don't, we're robbing them of opportunities to develop, right? Like you can't make these decisions, so you're not going to work on this project. I'll make the decisions. You just take the notes, right? But now they're lacking project management skills. And then when you get into a response, same thing. Oh, it's mother may I, which is delaying potentially resources. And, you know, back when I was a lieutenant running around Southwest Asia, you know, I was really like, I was the center of gravity. I had to make every single decision. And that's because I was young and I didn't want to fail because, you know, I thought it was that was a poor indicator of performance and a bunch of other stuff, right? And then if you look at me now, I take every opportunity to power down decision makings. And you're like, Sean, what do you mean? Like, I want to make as little decisions that I have to make because I want to power that down where the smartest people or the people with the most information can make those decisions. And, you know, don't bring me the $5,000 purchase request, bring me the $1 million issue. And so you see that evolution, and it's kind of hard too, because as a leader, you're like, you got to release, you know, the responsibility is never delegated, but the authority is, and to make a decision. And the real goal is, how do we set up an environment where folks are comfortable to make a decision, that it's a learning environment, that sometimes the decision may not be the best, most positive outcome. And then you and I also have to put something into the system that monitors for when we need to step in, right? And I think as a senior leader, those are the real important things that we do. And the results are amazing. It's just, we're having so much fun at the Department of Emergency Management and really solving some hard problems and serving our residents every day.
Now, you hit on a really good point there that, you know, decisions are best made at the level impacted, right? Honestly, if I were to bring you something, as you mentioned, the $5,000 decision, right? You might not make it a good decision as I would, because I'm closer. I mean, honestly, I've got to go through the whole thing with you. I'm not going to have time to tell you all the circumstances around it. You're busy. And at the end of the day, I was in a better position to make the decision than you are. And I think that as a leader, you know, we have to have that trust and empower people to make those decisions and be willing to, as you said, step in when necessary, make course corrections. But I think you and I would both agree we'd much rather people make decisions than fail to make decisions. And then that in and of itself becomes the decision in and of itself, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I mean, you and I would bog down with these $5,000 issues or, you know, but who's got their head up looking forward, right? And so that robs the organization of someone that's watching our backs and looking what that future threat's coming that's down the pike. So you're absolutely right. We can't bog down. It's really a disadvantage to the entire organization.
Right. So let's change gears a little bit. Country recently has experienced some pretty catastrophic events that were really unexpected with these storms that came up and came up through the mountains in North Carolina and southwestern Virginia and such, and really surprised a lot of people, and was a weather event like we've really never seen before. I know y'all activated along with another states, and we provided mutual aid as well as providing aid to the citizens of the Commonwealth there. But tell us a little bit about some examples or vignettes of things that took place during this activation where these leadership principles maybe were on display.
Yeah, definitely. You know, everybody really focuses on that response phase because, you know, we're really, you know, it's life saving, right? And by the way, who doesn't like, you know, burning aircraft fuel, you know, and spinning blades and all, but here's a really great example of what happens when you power down and share consciousness and you you develop this culture of learning and making connections across the entire organization. You know, folks begin to help each other out and really step up and step into not only challenges, but opportunities. So, but before we talk about the Helene response in Virginia, I want to set the stage. You know, when I first came into the job in January 22, you know, I met with the entire team and I said, hey team, here are my top three things that keep me up at night. And number one is cyber events. And, you know, our IT friends, they don't know crisis management exists. So they don't know that we can bring to the table all kinds of logistics and planning and, you know, recovery effort. And then on the emergency management side, you know, we're too afraid to step into the cyber domain because we don't know. It's an environment that we don't understand. So, you know, maybe we're afraid, whatever. Or maybe some folks don't think we have a role, but remember, that's just a crisis that needs to be managed as well. But number two was search and rescue, wide area search and rescue. That, you know, are we prepared for a tropical storm or a massive tornado outbreak and conducting wide area search? So, you know, over the last, you know, 5 years or so, our search and rescue program has dramatically developed. And I really empowered them in January 22. I was like, hey, guys, I know a Black Hawk costs about $9,000 an hour, but we're not gonna control that aircraft and make decisions for that aircraft from Richmond. Like that is not going to happen. And so let's develop the plan, and we're gonna exercise this thing to failure, and let's prepare for the future. And remember, that's more than just moving helicopters and swift water rescue teams on the ground. But you got to have an interoperable communication plan. You have a logistics plan, a resource plan for, you know, where do people go once we've made a rescue and all the above. So now, earlier in the summer, we had an event where we had some catastrophic rain headed towards us. We activated state of emergency, all that good stuff. And like we talked about that volatile environment that we live in. And during that response, it was very apparent that there was a massive shift in the storm track. And so instead of being like, west of Roanoke, Roanoke City, Roanoke Valley, you know, that storm had really shifted to the east. And for me, I was really concerned. I was like, all of our resources are staged to the west. And so I called our ops chief, Andy John, and I said, Hey Andy, I'm really concerned about this shift in track. Are you monitoring that? And I think we need to start. I said this. I think we need to start moving assets so that we're better postured. And he's like, "Hey boss, we've already done that. And by the way, you know, we spoke to the GIS team. You know, Jen McKee, just a fantastic group. We created the Virginia Resource Coordination System, the VARCS." And so now what they did is they took the forecast and put it on a GIS enabled platform with all of our teams and capabilities, and you can turn things on and off so they can visually see like where the threat is and where the capabilities are. And notice what he said, I've already done that. And so now, because of this culture and because of this shared consciousness, not only is the team reacting faster than the headshed, right? They're solving problems. Like the GIS folks said, you know what? I can visually depict the forecast rain, and that'll help you geographically understand where your capabilities are, and more importantly, where they should be. And so not only are we moving resources, but we're solving problems and being innovative, which is just awesome. And then driving towards Helene, like, you know, we were pretty sure we're going to have a fight with Helene here in Virginia. And so, you know, the governor declared and really provided us the resources to be successful. And, you know, we had 16 swift water rescue teams down in the impact area, pre-staged. At one point, we had 8 helicopters available. And then we had about 12 to 15 additional swift water rescue teams throughout the state that kind of on standby. And it's because of those relationships, because we had that plan, the culture, and so the results in about 18 to 24 hours, the Virginia team, and I say that very broadly, you know, state agencies, our localities are supporting this effort. and our comms team, 141 rescues just out of the state teams. That's not even including the localities, right? So 141 Virginians went home safe. They had over 300 contacts. The team stopped counting contacts after 300. And you know, a contact is, hey, taking somebody out of a house that maybe wasn't swift water yet. It was maybe, you know, 9 inches on the ground. Let's walk you out of here and get you out of here. And so the organization performed really well and thinking outside the box, like providing local emergency managers with forecasted inundation maps prior to landfall. And what does that mean? The local emergency managers evacuated low-lying areas, you know, 24, 48 prior to. And I'll just summarize with this. Like, this was a water event. And in Virginia, our greatest threat is flooding, the risk of flooding. And we had zero casualties, zero deaths related to water. We had, you know, two, unfortunately, due to wind. We had some small tornadoes on the east side. But for the team to react and manage and decentralize control and mission decision making, it was a resounding success. Really proud of the entire team. And it was a lot of hard work. And just so thankful for the first responders and the coordinators that made that a reality.
That's pretty incredible. I mean, we all know that water is the number one killer here, you know, when it comes to these types of disasters. And the fact that we didn't have any in the Commonwealth says a lot to those folks that were out there doing that. You know, I've started coining this phrase. It says recover fast, respond faster, right? And what I mean by that is we're seeing people move away from the standard model of I need something, it goes through a set of approvals, those approvals take place, and then eventually at the end of the guy at the pointy end of the spear gets what they need, right? And we all have to be a good steward of the taxpayer's dollar, right? When we're talking about federal dollars, there's rules and things that go along with that, but we have to find ways, and we're seeing things happen out there today where those processes are happening in parallel. Being a good steward of the taxpayer's dollar and responding faster is starting to happen. We're starting to see the finance people more closely tied to the operator, not as a hindrance, but as an enabler. And that cultural shift is beginning to take place in many places. And I think this new leadership model, right, is going to help with that. It's going to help with the idea of people are going to be empowered to do the things they need to do, get what they need, but at the same time, making sure we're stewards of the financial trust that has been placed on us.
No, you're hitting the nail on the head. You know, you said empowered, and I want to come back to that. But it's important, like, to establish these same relationships and processes during Blue Sky Day. You know, in terms of financial management, because at the end of the day, crisis management is really about logistics and funding. And so during Blue Skies Day, what is your policy and procedures? Are they decentralized as much as possible? Do they have proper oversight and audit, you know, built into it? Are you innovative? Are you leveraging technology? But, you know, we talked about that rescue scenario just a couple minutes earlier. Those processes and success absolutely applies during Blue Sky Days. And if you have that same behaviors and expectations during Blue Sky, it will spill over into the, you know, dark sky days, response times. But empowerment is huge. And I think it's an important part of the culture. And a couple things on empowerment is I think teammates are much more happy when they get to own projects and programs, right? I'm proud of what I've done. I've developed this project or this program. I get to make decisions about it. I get to move forward, and that's huge. And it's almost like an appreciation thing. And then you're building trust. And then the other thing, remember, if you're giving them opportunity to develop and prepare them for their next step, and you have to empower folks so they can learn and then grow, right? Otherwise, I mean, as an organization, you're just going to die on the vine.
Well, Don, I want to thank you very much for your time today. I want to thank you for your friendship, your service to the Commonwealth and to this nation. It's really incredible. And, you know, I look forward to continuing to follow what's going on in the Commonwealth and your leadership there. Thank you very much.
Well, Ross, thanks for having me and really appreciate the opportunity. I always learn something when I talk to you. So thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to the KPMG Emergency Management Dialogues podcast. Don't forget to subscribe for more enlightening episodes.